in the new year. And I was thinking this week, how do we meet our tough times? Especially when we think the tough times are about to end and then they don't. We think, oh, you know, the vaccines have arrived or things are winding down, and then suddenly it's not quite the case anymore. How do we go forward? What do we do? Well, a little while ago, I was reading some parts from this book. I'll just hold it up here, if you can quite see it. The title of the book is Bringing Zen Home, The Healing Heart of Japanese Woman's Rituals. And it's a book by a woman scholar and practitioner, Paula Arai. And Kate and I have had a chance to meet her and talk with her at a conference that was held in Vancouver a while ago. And she's done several books. But this particular book that I was looking at, the book highlights how various lay Japanese women who are Soto Zen practitioners make creative use of their domestic activities, like cleaning, cooking, raising children, caring for the sick and the dying, as ritual activities. And in doing so, they gain a sense of wholeness and stability in the very midst of the illness, the loss, the stress that appears in their lives. And I'm deeply moved by the women described in the book and the strength of their devotional practices, their compassion and their insight. So I recommend it. It's a bit of an unusual book, but I think it offers much. So perhaps it's time. It is time that Zen in the West kind of reconsidered these kinds of practices, which for a word, I'm just calling them devotional practices, as part of our complete practice of how we express our lives, how we enliven our practice in the world. COVID has been with us now for about 2 years, and it has been a time, I think for everyone, of great disruption, requiring us to respond appropriately to new information, new conditions, as they kind of seem to constantly arise. So how do we respond? How do we respond knowing so many people around the world are ill with COVID, that so many have died from COVID, and how do we respond to the disruption of our own lives during this time? So I think we should consider some possibilities that go along with our Zazen practice. And today I'd like to suggest one possibility, and that is the chanting that we do, but particularly the chanting of the Enmei Juku Kanangyo, the Sino-Japanese chant that we often offer when somebody is ill or in distress. Now, I realize I've talked about this chant before, and I'll post the chant in just a moment on the chat so you can have a look at it and follow along as we talk about it, if you're not familiar with it. It is at its very core, I think, a compassion practice, bringing forth compassion from our heart, for ourselves and also for the world, for those around us. And it's a practice that I have personally found of great benefit. But before we touch onto the practice of the Enmei Juku Kanangyo, I want to first acknowledge that it is true that Dogen, the Japanese monk who brought our form of practice from China to Japan, and actually is kind of really the founder of Soto Zen practice as we know it, it is true that Dogen extols the practice of Zazen, just simple, upright sitting, all through his writings. And here are some examples. Dogen writes, "Zazen is the ultimate practice. This is indeed the true self. The Buddha Dharma is not to be sought outside of this." Pretty strong emphasis on simply our meditation practice, our Zazen practice. He writes also another place, "Know that the true Dharma emerges of itself during the practice of Zazen, clearing away hindrances and distractions." Or another place, "Sitting upright, practicing Zazen is the authentic gate to free yourself in the unconfined realm of this samadhi. From the first time you meet a master, without depending on incense offering, bowing, chanting Buddha's names, repentance, or reading the scriptures, just wholeheartedly sit and thus drop away body and mind." Well, this is kind of the emphasis, I think, that we have received in the West from people who have studied Dogen and teaching Dogen. But my sense is this, that these admonitions that he gave about the emphasis of the meditation practice, of the Zazen practice, were very important for his audience at the time. Because those monks, the ordained people that he was addressing at the time, were often enamored with other practices that were very popular in Japan at that time, like the repeated chanting of Buddha's name. Namamidots, or tantric rituals involving fire and different visualizations. Pilgrimage to sacred sites, very popular in Japan. And of course, the deep study of all the Buddhist canon, all the various academic texts. And I think Dogen's purpose in his emphasis on Zazen was not to disparage these other practices, but rather to encourage his audience, who are again mostly ordained monks and nuns, to deeply engage in the Zazen practice without distraction. Now, I think this because when we look at Dogen's other writings, we can see that Dogen in other places puts emphasis on faith and encourages people to take, for example, refuge by chanting the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. He writes, he gives the advice that one should ceaselessly chant, "I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha." "Whether asleep or awake, we should respectfully keep in mind the great spiritual benefits of the three treasures and respectfully call upon the three treasures." Dogen also encourages the copying, you know, writing out by hand the sutras, particularly the Lotus Sutra, as a wonderful practice. And indeed, in his own life, when Dogen was dying, he had lung element he was dying from. When he was ill and near death, he took out a long sheet of paper, and on that paper, he wrote the characters for Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then he hung that paper in his sick room. And weak from his illness, he got out of his bed and circumambulated the pillar, going around and around the pillar, chanting Namo Amida Butsu, Namo ki ho, namo ki so, namo ki ho, namo ki butsu, namo ki ho, namo ki so. I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. Over and over again, that was his practice. So, let me go back to a suggestion that I'm giving forth of another practice that we could perhaps use at this time in our situation. I have always appreciated the Enmeijuku Kanongyo, and I'm just going to put that in chat for those of you who are not aware of that chant. Okay. Good. I learned this in Japan, and I've always appreciated this. In Japanese, it's called the Enmeijuku Kanongyo. For those who know those who know the Chinese, you can get a sense of it right away. I think partly because I've liked it because I have a challenge. It's for me challenging to memorize poems or jokes or pithy one-liners. But this chant I managed to memorize fairly early on. And it's been a great source of solace for me over decades. It's relatively short. And when we chant it, we repeat it 7 times usually, which we'll do in service today. Or sometimes it's repeated 108 times over and over again. Particularly in the Rinzai tradition, the other school of Zen. Morning practice, when I was doing some Rinzai practice with a Japanese teacher, we would start the day by chanting this vigorously 108 times over and over and over again. No coffee needed when you do that to wake up. So I chanted this temples in Japan, temples here. Now, I don't remember when exactly, but at some point I found myself chanting the Enmeijuku Kanongyo in times of deep distress or in times of deep sadness. When my mind would not settle on my breath and my body just felt agitated, I just couldn't do much. I remember once Jan Chosen Bays, the co-abbot at the Great Vow Monastery down in Portland, Oregon, she told me, when times are darkest and we are lost in our own pain, the only thing that will give aid is chanting. But if the chanting is going to be of benefit in those times, we have to lay the foundation for that practice now. So as I said, I learned this chant in Japan and practiced it in Japan and then also here. So let me give you an example. Chanting the Enmeijuku Kanongyo helped me as I sat in the hospital with my dying mother for several days before she died. She was unable to respond in any way, kind of in a coma, I guess. And so I sat at her bedside and quietly chanted the Enmeijuku Kanongyo to myself over and over again. It kept me present beside her. It kept my heart opening. And sometimes I was chanting for her, wishing her ease. Sometimes I was chanting for myself. Containing my sadness and grief. And sometimes for everyone else in the hospital, working so hard to ease pain and to heal. And sometimes I chanted for all beings who have lost or who are losing their mother. Now, I suppose it doesn't really matter what you chant. It could be a very moving poem that has inspired you. It could be lyrics from a song, perhaps, that you chant or repeat. But I can tell you from my experience, it helps to have a strong connection to the words, to the chant, the poem, the song, so it smoothly makes its way off the tongue, or it smoothly makes its way off the mind's tongue. During that time with my mother chanting the Inmei Jikku Kanengyo, I maintained a subtle connection to breath, voice, body. And some of the time, I could let go. I could release that kind of tight knot of grief, anger, despair, and that kind of ever-repeating story how this should not be happening. And that's what the Inmei Jikku Kanengyo is all about. It's about connection. It's about intimacy. And it's about compassion. It's such a short verse or sutra. And yet it has been part of the Zen tradition for hundreds and hundreds of years. I read recently that the great and late Chinese Chan teacher, Sheng Yen, first encountered this sutra while he was living in Japan. Not in all his training and time in China and Taiwan had he encountered it. And realizing somehow it had been lost to China, he brought it back with him from Japan to Taiwan, where the main center is. As I mentioned earlier, it is traditional at all the Soto Zen centers to chant the Inmei Jikku Kanengyo 7 times when members of the community or family or friends are ill or in deep distress. This chanting is offered as a support and a way of focusing our attention on those facing a medical emergency, a long difficult illness, or some other kind of crisis in their life. We also chant the Inmei Jikku Kanengyo for ourselves. Just as the Bodhisattva vows include the person who is saying those vows, we also chant for our own troubled heart, our own sick bodies. So, chanted daily in Zen temples all around Japan and now throughout North America and Europe, it's one of the few sutras that we still chant mostly in Sino-Japanese, although there are a number of translations that are available. And I'll try to share some of those at the end, again, in chat. But for now, let's take a look at the sutra itself that I posted and see what the sutra is telling us. Now, I don't know if I can half share my screen. I'm just going to give it a quick try before I go on. And if this doesn't work, sorry, I don't think I can do it. So we'll just have to look at the one in chat as we go through this. Maybe just a word about sutras in general, just for before we launch into this. Sutra refers to all of the kind of really important texts within Buddhism, but it's a little bit complex. Because the basic approach is that they're spoken by the Buddha. These are words spoken by the Buddha. But this is not the literal truth. It's more of a poetic truth, or an acknowledgement that the text itself is very profound, full of meaning, worth of deep respect, and of our own contemplation of it. We know that this particular text, this sutra, the Enmeijoku Kanengyo, was not written in Sanskrit or Pali, any of the early texts. It was composed in Chinese language. Perhaps as a hymn of praise or a verse of practice focusing on Kannon or Kanzayon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara. And it is, though, part of the official Chinese Buddhist canon. But we don't know its origins, who actually wrote it. But there is, which I won't go into, a kind of lore about how it came about to be. So, let's have a look at the verse itself. We'll kind of go quickly verse by verse and just kind of see what this is offering us. So it begins Kanzeon, the first line, Kanzeon. This is, as I said, Avalokiteshvara in Sanskrit, the Bodhisattva of compassion. Now, when we look at the Chinese characters, the name Kanzeon, you'll also hear Kannon, that's the same, but Kanzeon is how the Chinese began to try to transliterate Avalokiteshvara. In other words, they tried to grasp the meaning of Avalokiteshvara and put it into Chinese. So the characters mean something like the one who perceives the cries of the world, we could say. The one who perceives the cries of the world. And this translation, although I'm not sure, I think it first appears in the Lotus Sutra, for those who are interested. But basically, to hear the cries of the world. Now, Kanzeon or Avalokiteshvara or Kannon, she's described by many names, often in China and now in the West, appears in a feminine form. And sometimes you'll see statues of her with many hands, in order to respond to all the many needs that people have. And often in each of the hands, there's often an eye. So to see and be able to respond to whatever is necessary, to offer whatever aid is needed. But it's the name itself I want us to think about for a moment here. This name, Kanzeon, hear the cries of the world, encourages us to cultivate the willingness to listen deeply to the sorrow when we meet it, our own sorrow and the sorrow of others, rather than to turn away or to try fix immediately. Listen. And with the capacity to listen, we then begin to naturally bring forward our ground of compassion. Kanzeon teaches us not to shield ourselves from the suffering and anguish of the world as much as we want to, and perhaps at times we need to. Because when we shield ourselves, that simply leads only to painful separation. Kanzeon, the one who hears the cries of the world. Now, in Asia, Kanzeon, this great bodhisattva of compassion, not only hears the cries of the world, but she responds in whatever way is appropriate to relieve suffering. And sometimes listening is enough to really deeply hear the pain someone is in, to deeply hear and be with your own pain. Sometimes that's enough. But the Buddhist literature of China and Japan is full of stories of Kanzaiyan coming to the aid of those in need, whether they ask for it or not. Indeed, Dogen, when he was on that perilous journey from China to Japan, way back in the 1200s, by ship, and it was a challenging journey to make, he called out to Kanzaiyan in the midst of a storm, probably frightened. In Zen, in this tradition, the understanding is that Kanzaiyan is none other than our own innate and limitless compassionate heart. She embodies, or she personifies, loving kindness and compassion. So when we invoke, when we call Kanzaiyan, we invoke something that is within us, within ourselves, a profound and a boundless compassion. So in the midst of the storm, when Dogen called out to Kanzaiyan, he was calling out to something deeper than his terrified self. When I chanted the Enmejiku Kanungyo beside my dying mother, I was evoking a heart that could hold the sadness, anger, and helplessness that I felt. So Kanzaiyan may not save us in the ways we would like. She may not save us in the ways that we imagine. But nevertheless, we are saved. The next line in the poem goes, Namu Butsu. Namu basically means homage to. And Butsu means Buddha. So we could say, oh, homage to Buddha. But I'm not sure this is really an appropriate translation here. It strikes me more of a declaration, perhaps, of our own Buddha nature. A declaration that we too are Buddha. Mel Sojin, the late Zen abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center and Norman's teacher, he translates this line as meaning at one with Buddha. At one with Buddha. And this is an interesting translation too, because really Buddha is not sitting on the altar over here. Buddha is not 2,500 years in the past. Buddha is now, looking out through our own eyes, hearing the words through our own ears. That's the understanding in the Zen tradition of Buddha. Namu Butsu, one with Buddha. At this moment in our life, we may feel confused, we may feel cranky and suffering, and yet, we are far more than this crankiness, this pain, this confusion. At one with Buddha. When sitting in Zazen, we return to that understanding sometimes. Or at least we begin to open to that part of ourselves that is well beyond the confused, the cranky, and the suffering. And then this teaching is developed a little bit further in the next two lines. Yobutsu-u-in, yobutsu-u-en. The yo, I guess I would translate as kind of like with. And Buddha, of course, is butsu is a Buddha, right? U means kind of like is or has. It's kind of a connecting. So the first line goes, yo butsu u in. And in is a interesting character. It means kind of like a direct or fundamental cause. It's often connected with karma, the basic cause, a fundamental cause. So we could translate this line, perhaps, as similar to the other one, you know, that at heart we are Buddha. Our fundamental cause is our Buddha nature. Something like that. It's pointing to the awareness of the ineffable Buddha nature that we have, that we are, that we experience sometimes when we settle deeply into our Sazen practice, when that sense of deep spaciousness arises. Or perhaps when we've crested a long and steep rocky hill and finally, suddenly, there is a vast vista, landscape before us. And all the thoughts of our sweat and toil of getting up and cresting that final hill, that final point, just drop away. And for one moment, we are the vista. For one moment, we are that great landscape that is before us. Yo butsu u in, one with the Buddha nature. The next line, yo butsu u en, that's a little different character at the end there. It kind of means conditions or enabling conditions. It refers to that long walk up the hill that allowed us to experience the great vista. It is what allows us to actualize. The conditions allow us to actualize and bring forward, to open to our innate Buddha nature. So this line encourages us to remember that even in the times of great stress, of despair, and of sadness, we are still, even at that moment, one with Buddha. We still are our Buddha nature. Our practice is like a catalyst. And this is kind of another way you could maybe translate N is kind of like a catalyst. Our practice is a catalyst. Because even though Buddha nature is not something lost and then found again, it has been with us from the beginning. But as Dogen writes, we have to actualize it. We have to make an effort to really allow it to come forth fully in our lives. Yo butsu u en. Bringing forth our great Buddha nature, allowing it to flower in the world fully, free from hindrance and distraction. And then we see this kind of reinforced a little bit in the next line, that bupo so en. I mistyped that. It should be bupo so en, not butsuho so en. My mistake. Sorry about that. Bupo bupo so en. So this is like saying the enabling conditions of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The three treasures. So these three treasures, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, are enabling conditions. They are supporting causes that allow us to really fully inhabit and be who we completely are. They are the supports or the framework on our journey to fully actualize our true nature. And there's lots of ways to kind of understand this. You know, Buddha could be perhaps the example, the exemplar that we wish to follow. The Dharma can be the instructions, the skillful means to allow us to really bring forth our innate wholeness. And the Sangha, of course, are the good friends who encourage us, who aid us on this journey, help support us when we stumble, help pick us up again. These are, of course, enabling conditions, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Jo Raku Gajo, the next line there, Jo Raku Gajo. Basically means permanence, happiness, true self, and purity. What on earth? What's that doing there all of a sudden? Well, these are the four qualities of a Buddha's life, as expounded in another sutra, the Maha Parinirvana Sutra. Permanence, happiness, true self, and purity. Four qualities of the Buddha's life. Now, I imagine there are teachers who could probably talk for several days on what these qualities are and what they mean. But basically, they're the opposite to the conventional qualities of this world, the Saha world. So, first one the Buddha talked about, of course, was impermanence, right? Everything is impermanent. There is dissatisfaction, dukkha. So anicca, dissatisfaction, anatta, the non-self, and also impurity. So what are these qualities then? Permanence. Well, it's permanence in a different way of understanding permanence. Now, I know some of you have practiced Tibetan Buddhism. So in Tibetan Buddhism, they often talk about, or at least in some traditions, talk about sky mind. I think that's a beautiful image, sky mind. And I think this really illustrates this sense of permanence, because the sky is endless, right? The sky is always changing, but it is, even though it always changes, still the sky. Clouds appear, clouds disappear, the sun rises, sun disappears, moons come, stars appear, but it's always the sky. This sense of permanence, which I think is leading us to the sense of this profound intimacy that we have with all things. This vast groundedness, endless, permeating everything. I think this is what Joe, this sense of permanence, is talking about. And Raku means pleasure, enjoyment, the constant and full enjoyment of the present moment, no matter what it is. And I think this is referring to our willingness to meet this present moment, even if that moment is tragic. There can be a kind of joy there. And again, could probably talk for several days on pulling this apart, but let me put it this way. I talked earlier about sitting by my mother as she was dying in the hospital. And when I reflected back on that, there was a kind of joy. There was a kind of joy there. Not something I would wish on somebody else or wish to go through again, but still it was there. I think this is what this raku means. This present shiningness that every moment has, no matter what it contains. Jo raku ga. Ga means a true self, as opposed to the false self or anatta. And true self means the big mind or the Buddha nature that we have. That self that which goes beyond all notions of that we have about ourself or all notions we have about non-self. It is perhaps that profound intimacy, as I spoke about earlier, with everything. And finally, Jo, in that last line, as I said, means purity or clarity, free from any possible stain, free from any sense of separateness, just like clear water, all the way down to the bottomless bottom, pure. So these are the qualities. These endless, beautiful qualities representing the ineffable. This is what we evoke in ourselves when we chant the Inme Jikku Kanungyo. All very beautiful and rather abstract, perhaps. So the next line brings us right back to the practice, to directly meeting each moment in this messy world, to meet each moment of our confused lives. Cho nen kanzayon. Cho means morning. And nen means kind of like a conscious thought or a kind of awareness, we'll say. So this phrase basically has the meaning of in the morning, be aware, kanzayon. Be aware of kanzayon, however you understand that. The hearer of the cries of the world, be aware of compassion. Be aware of this profound intimacy. Cho nen kanzayon. Morning, awareness, kanzayon. In the morning, throughout the day, invoke your compassion. You know, I was thinking how often I wake up in the morning and the first thing is like the to-do list. What I've got to do today and what I don't want to do today, but have to do anyway. Or the worries about relationships, you know, or money, work, all those kind of things. Lining up, demanding attention. So perhaps we could discipline ourselves to cultivate thoughts of compassion, even for a moment before our feet hit the floor. Maybe laying in the bed a few moments before we even open our eyes but we're awake, we can say, Cho nen kanzayon. This morning, compassion. This morning, hearing the cries of the world. I wonder, what would the day be like then? The next line, well, we talked about morning, now it's night. Bo nen kanzayon. Evening or night, so in the evening, throughout the night, turn your mind to kanzayon. So here the Inme Jikku Kyo exhorts us to practice day and night, returning to compassion, returning to the intimacy as it's embodied, as we understand it, in kanzayon. Well, reinforced a little bit again, nen nen ju shinki. As I said, nen means a kind of conscious thought or awareness. So awareness after awareness, right? Because we have to keep coming back to awareness. We always spin off. This moment, coming back, thought after thought, awareness after awareness. Ju means to follow. Shin is heart, and ki means arise. So thought after thought arises within our vast heart mind, kind of like clouds in an empty sky, in an endless sky, clouds, thought after thought. Sitting in Zazen, thoughts arise, thought after thought arises, And we're not separate from those thoughts. And when we, by meaning not separate from those thoughts, means we don't engage them. We see them as just something arising and something disappearing. Within the context of that endless sky mind, that great big mind of awareness. Last line, nen nen hu di xin. Well, as above, nen nen means thought after thought. Hu means not or no, not. Di means separate. And xin again means your heart or heart mind. So thought after thought arises, and yet not separate. We don't separate from our great awareness, our great heart mind. Thoughts are not bad any more than clouds are. Clouds and sky are most intimate. Thoughts and our heart mind, most intimate. And just as the sky does not chase after the clouds, in our awareness we don't chase after our thoughts. They arise, they have their function, they go. So thoughts, heart, mind, kanzayon, most intimate. Well, that's kind of my 2 cents worth on the Enmei Jukku Kanangyo. And there's much more that we could say about it. There's many ways to translate this text. And just hang on a second. I'm just going to put some of them in the chat for those of you who may be interested in this. It's not working for some reason. Okay. Sorry. I thought I could. It worked before. Why aren't you working now? Try one more time and then I'll stop. No, it's not going to do it for me. Sorry about that. I'll try post them on the website then, so you have some other translations to look at. Anyway, let me just go back for a moment to the very beginning. We do live in very challenging and painful times. But we have our practice. And our practice, returning to it wholeheartedly, will ground us, will allow us to stand upright, to face these buffeting winds. But it will do more. I think in every way that we can, we need to bring our practice into the world. We need to find ways to share this so that it does relieve the suffering of others. This is our bodhisattva vow, to bring ease and comfort to those all around us, to those without practices, especially, I think. So maybe the Enmei Jikku Kanon Gyo will be helpful for you, or maybe there'll be another chant that you will, or a song or a poem. Please pick something. Make it part of your daily practice for a while. Become deeply intimate with it. So that, as Chosen Bays said, when we need it, when we really need it, when we are caught in distress, beyond our ability to sit quietly with it, it will be there, and it will bring great comfort.